Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today we have Peter Tor. Peter is a PM on the Windows Phone Development Platform team. Peter, how are you?
I'm great, thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm really happy to have you here. We also have John Galloway, my erstwhile compatriot on this podcast. John?
That's right.
So this is a very powerful combination of people because I know, Peter, that you certainly have a great deal of expertise in, and you presented at Build and in Mix on multitasking, and John just did a presentation at Dev Connections on background tasks. So there's a host of things for us to talk about. But before we started, while we were getting set up, Peter, you mentioned some special issues around the back button. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we could talk about that to begin with, if you'd like.
Sure, that would be great.
Sure. So I recently posted a blog about what the back button means on Windows Phone, especially in conjunction with some of our newer Mango features, like deep linking through secondary tiles or through toasts or through alarms and reminders. We've seen some people kind of get a bit confused about what the back button should do when their app is launched through one of these deep links. So I can just kind of summarize the post, if you like, and then presumably in the post for this, you can point people to the URL if they want to read further.
Yes, that would be great.
Cool. So basically, if you look at the way that the Windows Phone built-in applications work, there's a very consistent user model where forward navigations, that's navigations from the start menu or from toasts or reminders, launch you into certain experiences. And then the back button always takes you back to where you were before you launched into that experience. I'll give you an example of, say, the People Hub. If you click on the People tile on start, it goes into the People Hub. And if you hit back, you go back to the start menu. And if you pin a particular person from the People Hub, you know, say your significant other, you pin them to the start menu, then you tap on that icon, you are then taken to that person's People card, and if you hit the back button, you go back to the start menu. You don't go from the People card into the All People Hub. So it's kind of, it's a back navigation, not an up navigation in kind of the information hierarchy. And that's repeated throughout the operating system. If you pin albums from Zune, or you pin directions from Maps, or pictures from the Picture Hub, they all work in the same way. And that is back always takes you back to where you came from.
Right. I think you hit that summary, and I really want to emphasize that back means back, and it doesn't mean up. And that, I think, really crystallizes that difference, is that you're not going up into the more general area that when you have a deep link, you're going back where you came from.
Exactly. The idea being that these things like these secondary launch points, like secondary tiles or toasts, are really there for the user to quickly dive into that specific piece of information. So the specific thing they pinned to start, or the specific notification they're getting through a toast, and they can deal with that specific piece of information, and then they can get back to whatever they were doing, whether that's the start menu from a secondary tile, or, you know, maybe they were browsing the web when the toast came in, or they were doing something else. So the idea is that you can get into the information and then back to what you were doing very, very quickly. And, now, that works for a lot of the build. Oh, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, Peter, you summed this up on a recent blog post, and I thought the way that you showed this using a lot of examples and showing you have some great visuals there that make it kind of obvious exactly what you're saying. And it's hard to always to talk about software, but you know, for people listening that want to see a visual representation, I thought your diagrams here were very useful.
Oh, cool. Yeah, thanks. And the blog post, it's on blogs.msdn.com/ptor. It's my most recent blog. It's called Back Means Back, not forwards, not sideways, but back.
We'll put a link to that on the page for this show as well.
Great. That'll be awesome. The idea is that you get into things and get out of them very quickly. Now, we know that there are cases where this particular type of navigation might not exactly match what the user wants to do. And one of the examples I gave in the blog is, let's say that you've pinned a wish list to the start menu. So you have a shopping type app of your favorite store, and you've pinned your wish list so that, you know, as you're out and about and you think of new things that you want to buy, you can just quickly tap on the wish list icon, add the thing that you want to buy, and then go back to what you were doing. So the in and out model. But at some point in time, you might want to actually purchase the things in your wish list. Right? So you go to the start menu, you click on your wish list, and then you click the buy button. And that takes you through a sequence of operations to, you know, put in your billing information, put in your credit card, and so on. And eventually when you're done, you want to know what to do next. So in that case, once the user has gone into the billing and the credit and so on, you don't want the back key to necessarily go back through the credit card and the billing information, because that's kind of, it's now stale. And so with some of our new APIs that we added in Mango, you can remove things from the back stack to make some of these flows more natural, so that once you've finished your purchase, you can go back directly to the wish list and not through the billing and the credit card.
So programmatically, you would do this programmatically. You would say for when you get to that last page, that's a confirmation on the purchase, you would remove end pages from the backlist at that point.
Yep. And at that point, you are now back at the original wish list page, which is probably now empty because you have removed all the items from it because you just purchased them. And so that's one case where you might go from a secondary launch point into a deep link in your app. And from there, you can still continue on and do other things, but it's in a constrained fashion. And we have some other APIs that help you clean up the back stack so you can still get out very quickly.
One of the places that John and I ran into an issue around the back stack was with logging in and authentication.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we needed to manipulate the back stack so as to exit the application and not back up through the authentication pages.
Yeah. So in Windows Phone 7, there was a cookbook recipe put out for the non-linear navigation service. And that was an API that you could use to kind of recursively remove items from your backstack. It wasn't the most efficient way of doing it. And what we've done in Mango is we've added an explicit API to let you do that in a more efficient manner. So you can now remove those things, like login pages is another example, where you want to remove things so they don't actually exist in the backstack.
This is a quick question for me, which is that at one point the guidance was not to have a back button in your application, to only use the hard back button on the phone. Is that still the guidance?
Yeah, predominantly, if you look at our built-in applications, they don't really have a software way of going back. It's always through the hardware button. And we continue to recommend that you don't have any UI buttons that explicitly say back. You know, you can have a button that says okay or done or something like that that completes a task, which implicitly, you know, pulls the page off the back stack and takes you back to where you were. But we don't foresee the use of, you know, little back arrows or things like that on the screen that would take you back. What we do think of in some of these more complex cases is the notion of a home button. So, you know, before we talked about the back button not going up in your information hierarchy, but going back. In the cases where you do really want to go up to, say, the broader scope of the entire application from one of these deep links, we believe it's okay to add the notion of a home button to your application. And I talk about this in the blog, and there's some diagrams about that as well. So basically, if the user deep links into part of your app, the back key should take them back to where they came from, just like we've been talking about. But if they want to explore the app further and really get into the guts of the app, you can include the notion of a home button, which is kind of an explicit action by the user that says, I want to kind of get out of this silo that I deep linked into and back into the full application. And so you can do that. You can have a home button that then basically takes you to the starting page of your app. And using the same APIs to clear the back stack, you can remove that deep linked entry. And now from the home page, the user can start exploring your application. And if they hit back from the home page, they go back to the start menu or wherever it was they came from, because you've removed that kind of temporary page. So this is a kind of application design that we don't think is that common. We think that a lot of applications can be structured such that you don't really need the notion of home. But there are obviously cases where you do want to go home. And in that case, we believe this kind of model will still fit with the back key on the phone.
John?
Well, no, I was thinking this, I mean, and you've said that, you know, the idea of exploration, and it seems like the importance of consistency here is to allow somebody to feel that they can navigate through any application that's following these standards and not worry that they can't get back. And I've heard people gripe on other platforms that, you know, the home button or different buttons may mean different things depending on context, and it's confusing. Is really the idea to allow kind of a safe feeling of exploration through any application?
Yeah, and the idea that if you accidentally tap on something that you didn't mean to tap on, you just hit that back key and you're right where you were before, and you don't have to worry about hunting and pecking in the UI to figure out you know, where to get back to where you were. Mm-hmm. That's the whole purpose of it. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I know with any app, it's like once I get the feeling that I know how to undo anything and that I'm not going to accidentally delete or buy something, you know, then I feel a lot more comfortable to enjoy the application.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the multitasking capabilities that came in with Mango.
Okay. Do you want me to just kind of – actually, John, do you want to take this one?
Oh, gosh. Well, so yeah. So I had my recent, you know, kind of how do I cover all this in 1 hour? And some of the main things that I thought were interesting, there's background agents, there's scheduled. Let me see. Where's my big list? I'm sorry. I was unprepared for that.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
No. So here's my list that I came up with. We had background audio, background file transfer, and then scheduled notifications. Underneath that, you've got reminders and alarms. And then under scheduled tasks, you have periodic and resource intensive. So as I was trying to kind of wrap my mind around it and explain it, I was thinking that you've got kind of the general cases, which are like scheduled tasks and scheduled notifications. And then you have very specific applications in two cases, which are audio and file transfer.
That sounds right. And one of the things that I noticed when we were putting together that presentation is that there is, while it isn't exactly the same pattern between sound and periodic tasks and background file transfer, they're similar enough in the model of having a foreground application and then this templated background helper application in most cases that as you move through these, they get easier to get your head around and easier to implement.
Yeah, we wanted to go for consistency in the way that we split up the background and the foreground. It's not an accident that they're programmed the same way. And it's funny when we first thought about doing background audio. Obviously, it's a it's a popular feature and a lot of people have asked for it. But we thought, you know, there's only going to be 5 or 10 people in the world that ever write background audio apps. Boy, were we wrong. Huh. Seems like everybody is using that API.
Well, if you think about it in terms of I want to play music and keep the music playing, then I think you're right. It would be only a handful of users. But, you know, once you create something powerful like that, it gets used in all sorts of unanticipated ways. John and I, for example, are working on a Pomodoro timer. And we very much would like to have the ticking sound continue, even if you leave the application to go do something else, to remind you that that time is passing. And the background audio capability made that possible in a way that just wasn't before.
Yeah, and anything that needs to continuously play some kind of sound. One thing I should caution against is trying to use background audio player to do something that isn't play sound. That will not get you through ingestion. So if you are just trying to run code in the background, but you aren't actively playing audio, that is not allowed. But as long as you're playing audio, even if it's like a ticking sound, and the user is aware that your app is running and that something is happening, you should be okay.
I will tell you that we had to kludge it together a bit in order to get continuous ticking. We certainly didn't want to create a 5-minute file for continuous ticking. And there isn't at the moment, I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, there isn't a way to say loop this sound.
The best way to do something like that is probably through MSS. So if you took a ticking sound, and you had the raw PCM data from that ticking sound, and then you fed it through MSS at the right rate and played silence for the rest of the time, you can implement looping yourself. Otherwise, you would have to create a set of dummy URLs that you pass to Zune and flip back and forth between them with the right amount of silence programmed in.
Right. John, mm-hmm. Did you follow that MSS idea?
Yeah, but, you know, we ended up with a simpler. So instead, what you're talking about, Peter, there's the streaming, and then there's also just a playlist approach. So you can queue up different tracks, or you can say, just play from a stream, right?
Yeah, so you can play individual URLs, either remote URLs or local URLs from your isolated storage, or you can use a Silverlight technology called MSS, where essentially Zune asks you for buffers periodically of raw audio, which lets you do dynamic audio decompression or decrypting or even dynamically creating audio and just providing the buffers straight to the media pipeline versus having them on disk or on the network.
So we ended up doing a dumber approach, partly to keep it simple for a demonstration, but we ended up just, when you're using a media's background audio, you have two sets of events that you respond to. One is user action, and one is kind of like I forget the actual term, but it's track action. Something happens. So when the track completed, I just set the position back to zero and said play again. So
yep, yeah.
Not a poor man's looping.
Yeah, no, that works too.
The issue of, I think, that a lot of folks stumble over is that if you're going to use local files, those files have to first be copied into isolated storage. But when I sat down to write a mini tutorial on what it takes to do that, it turns out to be pretty straightforward and pretty easy. So hopefully that won't be a hurdle for folks who want the audio to come from a local file.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a good segue into background transfer. Because if you want to copy a file from the network into your isolated storage, you can either write some HTTP web request code that, loops over a buffer and copies a buffer to disk and so on, or you can write, two lines of code to new upper background transfer and download from A to B and let us do it in the background. So that's kind of a cool segue into background transfer, even though you probably didn't even expect it to be.
Everything is intentional.
Okay. You're smarter than I thought about guiding the conversation.
And I thought that background file transfer is the samples that are up on MSDN are really slick there. And so you're registering files. You're saying, please download these files when conditions are met, meaning, that you're, say, on power and on Wi-Fi or that kind of thing, so that you're not, running out the user's battery or downloading or uploading a bunch of bandwidth when they're on roaming or something and costing them a lot of money. So, but I thought it's a really clean API because you just register files and you say, please upload or download this, and then you're done. It's fire and forget.
Yeah, and there's obviously progress notifications if you care about the progress, so you can show a progress bar or something. But if you just care about having it copied and then know when it's completed, there's an event for that, or you can poll next time your app starts, did this download complete while I was in the background? And it really is a much simpler API than trying to deal with buffers with HTTP web request.
Let me take you over to one of the simpler background, which is the reminders and the alarms. And can you talk a little bit about what went into the design decision to separate those into two separate APIs with somewhat overlapping capabilities?
I can give you kind of the veneer of an answer. I don't know the true depth of the answer to this one, unfortunately. But at a high level, if you look at the UI on the phone, again, going back to the built-in experiences of the phone, the way that alarms work and the way that reminders work are a little bit different. For alarms, for example, they aren't associated with any kind of deep content, right? It's just an alarm. So there's no deep link from an alarm back to your application. There's also no, from a UI perspective, there's no custom snooze time, 5, 10 minutes, an hour, whatever. There's just one snooze time. And I believe this is, kind of secondhand memory, but I believe the snooze is 9 minutes, and I believe we did some research to figure out that was the default snooze time that alarm clocks had. The alarm is more limited, and in the information it can display and what the user can do with it, but it does let you customize the sound, so you can play certain kind of alarm sounds. Reminders, on the other hand, are a bit more structured in that you can deep link into a specific piece of content, the user can snooze them for arbitrary amounts of time, and you don't get to specify a sound because you want the reminder experience to be consistent on the phone. So that's one of the reasons why the APIs are different, is because the UI is different. And so some properties work on reminders but not on alarms, and vice versa. So they're different, but we wanted them to be as similar as possible because they kind of work in the same way, right? You have a time you want it to go off. You add that to our scheduled action service, and it pops the alarm or the reminder at the appropriate time. So we wanted the programming to be familiar, but the concepts to be different.
It seemed that was one thing when I was explaining, that was one thing that felt like, as I was looking at all the different limitations and restrictions on the different tasks and alarms and notifications and things, that for just about every case, I could think through and say, I understand this is protecting the user, this is protecting the developer. But the one place that it did seem a little arbitrary to me was the difference between some of these things with reminders and alarms. For instance, on an alarm, you can customize this the notification sound. You can't customize that notification sound on reminders. But yet with reminders, there you can customize the title, and you can't customize the title with alarm. I was having a hard time understanding. You know, like most of the time with an API, you can kind of, once you understand what's being accomplished, you can kind of get a good intuitive guess of how it's going to work. And I didn't feel like I got that sense completely, like how I would know why I could customize the title on one, but not the audio and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And like I said, I can really only give you the veneer of the answer, but it does come down to the UX of the phone and wanting to keep the sound that you hear for reminders consistent, because you get to pick globally on the phone what reminder sound you want.
Mm.
And so if you've picked a particular tone, you know, that differentiates your reminders from, you know, everyone else's reminders in the room, you would want that. We believe you would want that sound to be consistent, whether no matter if the reminder was for a calendar item in your Outlook calendar or your Gmail calendar, or with, you know, your custom marketplace application that was reminding you to go and do something else. So that's why it's a bit more locked down. But we do get feedback from developers saying, hey, I would like some more flexibility here. But at least for Mango, these things are locked down a little bit to maintain the consistency of the UI for the user.
Okay. And I did think it was really cool that you are able to, with a reminder, that you can deep link into an application and not just, you know, link, not just open up the app, but actually pass in query string information and link directly into a page. So you can, a reminder can take you exactly into a safe state in an application or do something very specific.
Uh-huh. And it's funny, one of the hidden secrets of Windows Phone, a lot of people don't know this, is that when a reminder fires, even for a built-in calendar or a third-party reminder, if you tap on the text of the reminder, it does take you to that item, unless the screen is locked, because obviously if the screen is locked, we can't show you content before you type in your PIN. So that's a little known secret, because it's not obvious to the user that you can tap on those things. And, you know, most of the time, especially if you work at Microsoft with a, you know, enforced PIN policy, when a reminder pops up, your phone is locked, and so tapping on the reminder doesn't help. But if your phone is unlocked when a reminder fires, just tap on the text and it'll take you directly to that item.
Huh.
Let me take you back to the periodic tasks, which, as I understand the documentation, are going to run approximately every half hour, but there's a fair amount of leeway on that. I think it's as much as 10 minutes either way as to how often the periodic task will run. Can you talk a little bit about the design decisions that went into and the motivations that went into making that not a particularly precise interval?
Sure. Most of the constraints on our background agents, whether they're the periodic type or the resource intensive or even the audio type, they're all about conserving battery on the phone, because obviously we want our phones to last all day. And so things like the variability in the execution time stem from the fact that we want to share network radio usage, because bringing up the cellular radio is actually very, very expensive. And so if let's say you have a email account that is scheduled to sync every half hour, if the radio is already up because you're syncing email, we want to piggyback on that with our background agents. So any networking they do kind of amortizes the cost of bringing up the radio, because the way the cell radio works is that as soon as somebody needs it, we power it on, and, you know, it stays on in a high power mode, transmitting data and receiving data. And then when you're done, it stays on for a little while in case somebody else wants to use it. But after a short period of time, if no one uses it, you know, it drops back down to the low power state. And then, you know, at some other time, someone will ask for the radio and it will come back up again. And so by batching up all of your network activity into these kind of spurts of activity, you amortize that one cost of bringing up the radio, and you get all the data transmission done in a short period of time, and actually has a significant impact on a positive impact on your battery. And so the variability is, you know, partly to do with aligning with network usage. It can also be because if you have, you know, several background agents running, the time that they all run can vary. You know, they have up to 25 seconds each. So if you have several of them, they might run for a minute. And then, you know, the next time you run them, they may all run very quickly. And so there's variability built into how long the agents themselves run as well. And there's probably some other fuzz factors built into it as well. But I don't know the exact details of all the other reasons why we might kind of schedule off the half hour.
No, but that was brilliant. What that says is, as a developer, I tend to think about my application and I want it to run every 30 minutes. And I'm thinking of my application as if it were in a vacuum. But in fact, my application is in a system that has multiple applications that may have tasks to run. And by having that flexibility of plus or minus, you've got a much larger window where you have an opportunity to aggregate multiple things at a time. That explains it in a way that is extremely helpful, because otherwise it felt loose. And in fact, it's not at all loose. It's a fairly tight engineering design.
Yeah, and there are other things as well. So, you know, you can't assume that just because your background agent is scheduled that it'll always run. For example, if the phone goes into battery saver mode because it's running low on battery, you know, we will temporarily suspend the background agents so that they are not further draining your battery. So you can never assume that you're running every half hour or even, you know, every 25 minutes plus or minus a few minutes, because as the user uses their phone and as the battery drains, we may temporarily suspend your agents, and then when the battery gets charged again, we'll start scheduling them again.
Now, how extensive is that suspension? Does that include suspending reminders and alarms?
No, alarms and reminders, you know, essentially don't use any resources until they fire. You know, they're just an entry in a database somewhere, and then when the time comes, you know, we show the alarm or we show the reminder. So they're not really wasting battery. It's the, you know, the agents that actually do work that are the ones that are, you know, using resources.
I thought that was an interesting point. You were saying that it may not run every specific 30 minutes. It may drift. But there's another interesting warning that I saw in the documentation, which is don't depend on something happening at all. For instance, a background file transfer that is going to require a Wi-Fi connection. Well, some of your users may never use Wi-Fi. And so your application may, if you're, you know, you need to structure your application, not making assumptions that things are going to run on a schedule or in some cases at all.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. There's background transfers if you specify Wi-Fi, or if they're over 100 megabytes, they will only go over Wi-Fi. And if the user never connects to Wi-Fi, the transfer never happens. So your application should have some kind of logic to check, you know, I scheduled this transfer yesterday, you know, it hasn't even started yet. Maybe, you know, and you can check the status and it'll say waiting for Wi-Fi or waiting for power and Wi-Fi. And so you might want to tell the user, hey, you know, if you never connect to Wi-Fi networks, maybe you want to do this download in the foreground and, you know, keep the screen on. Another case with the same issue around Wi-Fi networks is the resource-intensive task. And so what it is it's another type of background agent that runs when the phone is essentially idle. When the phone is basically has a full battery, the screen is not on and hasn't been on for quite some time, and the phone is connected to a network that isn't a cell network, so that would be either Wi-Fi or desktop pass-through, then we run these agents, and we call them resource-intensive because they can run for batches of 10 minutes, and they can keep running for as long as the phone is in this state of turned off and you know, connected to a network. And they have no limit on how much CPU or bandwidth they can consume. So they're really good for downloading large amounts of data or syncing large amounts of data. But the caveat there is that if your user doesn't have a Wi-Fi network at home and they never, you know, plug their phone into USB into their PC, your agent will never run because we only run it when it's not using the cell network. So that's another case where the app might have specific functionality that depends on the user connecting to Wi-Fi.
I'm sorry, but are there still people who don't have Wi-Fi in their home?
I think specifically outside of the United States, yes. You know, when I travel to you know, Australia or other places, especially if you go to a hotel, Wi-Fi can be expensive or non-existent. So, you know, if you're traveling for a week, even if you plug your phone in overnight to charge, it might not be on a Wi-Fi network.
Astonishing. I'm appalled. Well, I'm sure many people listening are appalled at my comment, I'm sure. Go ahead, John.
Traveling, I'm sure, is a case. And in traveling is a point, too, where, you know, as I was traveling to Dev Connections and thinking about this while speaking, it's like I want to you do have times where you don't have Wi-Fi access during transit. And you also or it may be expensive, like you're saying, Peter. And then also, I really do care about my resources. I want my battery to last a long time and I don't want to worry about charging. And so all these kind of resource management things, I think it's great the balance that, you know, I can add all these features to my phone. I can make things more, you know, worthwhile to my users. But my user is being protected from the rogue application that's going to drain the battery or, you know, run up a huge cell bill overseas.
Yeah, and one of the kind of core principles we had when we designed multitasking in Windows Phone is that we absolutely didn't want to have a task manager on the phone where, you know, you load up a bunch of apps and then you realize that your phone is getting hot in your pocket and the battery drains in half a day, you know, and you have to go and figure out that, well, you have to go kill this process once in a while because it's, you know, it's gone rogue. So we really, really wanted to avoid that. And that's why there's so many of these kind of checks and balances in the system to make sure that these agents only run for short periods of time, you know, approximately every half an hour when the radio is up and so on and so forth. Now, that said, we do have the ability for the user to control which agents run and which ones don't in a control panel. But the primary purpose of that is not, you know, to stop an app because your battery is draining. The primary purpose of that one is simply because you don't want the functionality of that particular agent anymore and you want to temporarily turn it off. And the the kind of the canonical example I use there is, say you have a background agent that periodically checks your location and broadcasts it to some kind of a social network or checks you in somewhere. If you are planning a surprise party or buying an engagement ring or something like that should be kept secret, you probably want to turn off that functionality so that the phone isn't reporting your location every half hour to the person whose birthday party you're planning. And so in those cases, rather than having to go into the application and try and fiddle with its settings and find out where they kept the knob to turn off the agent, you can just go into the settings application, swipe across to the applications pivot and say background tasks, and you can turn off the background agent right there. And you can let the application turn it back on again the next time you launch the app. But you know, that's really for controlling whether you want the functionality of the agent or not. It's not for controlling battery or bandwidth usage because the system is already managing all of that for you.
I thought that was going way back to background audio, another example there of the kind of putting the user in control. It was nice that, you know, you can cue things up, but there's a universal volume control, and, you know, the controls are always there so that a user, even though you've got background audio playing, can get in and say, you know, turn the volume down. I've had on previous, like an Android phone where I've got a background podcast player and then all of a sudden it starts playing and I'm fiddling around, you know, trying to turn the volume down in the middle of a meeting or something. And so I like the idea of kind of putting that management, you know, making it accessible and constant throughout the applications.
Yeah, it's all kind of part of our, you know, integrated applications, bringing things together on the phone so that they're not just these silos of functionality. We want kind of everything to seem consistent and very familiar and easy to use for our customers.
What kind of a response are you getting from the developer community in terms of some of these restrictions? Are they well understood and accepted, or are you getting a fair amount of pushback?
I think it's a little of column A, a little of column B. Certainly the people that wanted to do audio before and couldn't are happy that they now have a way of doing background audio. Some of the folks that wanted to do periodic background tasks, like the new functionality, there a lot of people would like to run code more frequently. Some people would like to run code less frequently. You know, some people would prefer to run code all the time. But generally, people that understand why we've done why we've made these restrictions and that have scenarios that fit, things around updating my live tile with some latest Twitter information or blog information, for the kind of scenarios where the agents work, people really love the implementation that we have, and I think customers are going to love it too because of the fact that we protect their battery life.
Yes, that the trade-off there is there's good protection of the battery life. The only kind of application that comes to my mind that really is the door is shut on, given these constraints, is an application that's monitoring your location to give you notifications based on where you are. So something that says, you know, if I'm within two blocks of a Starbucks, pop up and tell me. That would be very, very difficult to run, given that you don't know how often your application's going to even have access to that API.
Yeah, I mean, that app is easier to write in Seattle because you're always two blocks away from Starbucks.
Good point.
But outside of Seattle, those kind of geofencing applications or geolocation aware applications are one class of thing that we would have loved to have done for Mango, but it just just didn't fit into the engineering time that we had to get Mango out the door. So we know it's a very compelling scenario, and we know that there are a lot of really cool apps you can build with it. We just couldn't get to it in Mango.
What's your favorite new feature in Mango?
My favorite new feature in Mango, other than fast application switching, which is awesome for the applications that have been updated, is probably groups. I did a video with Robert Hess a while ago demoing groups, because basically you can take a bunch of people that you communicate with a lot together in the same kind of social circle. So maybe your workmates or your close friends or your family, you can group them all together into a single live tile that you pin onto your start menu, and from there you can group SMS or group email them, and you can see all their updates on their social networks. And it's just a really easy way to keep in touch with separate groups of people, rather than having to go into your email and check for new email from specific people, or go into the People Hub and check for new items from specific people. You just get them all grouped together in one common UI.